It's good to see all of you. We have some visitors with us, and it's wonderful to have extras. It's wonderful to have you praising God with us, and we're glad you're here. We hope that we can get a chance to meet you and get to know you a little bit. If you haven't been here over the past several weeks, we've spent some time going through some of the shorter prophetic books of the Old Testament and seeing what each of them is trying to tell us or teach us about the character of the God that we serve. Last week we started talking about some things in the book of Daniel, and I suggested to you that what seems like the most central theme in the book of Daniel is the sovereignty of God, that God is ruler, God is in control, and even as his people go into captivity in this foreign land, this pagan superpower, it is God who is pulling the strings, it is God who is providing for his people, and it is God where trust should be placed for security and for provision. And so in chapter 1 of Daniel, we saw God being the one who gave Judah into the hand of Babylon. We saw God giving Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah, his servants who are in exile, we saw God giving them learning and skill, blessing them and placing them in high positions of influence. In chapter 2, we saw God as the one who reveals mysteries and possesses all knowledge. God is the source of understanding and wisdom. And he showed that to King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon in chapter 2. And in chapter 3, there's this great contest in chapter 3, one of the more familiar stories in the book, this great contest between the power of Nebuchadnezzar, who begins the chapter with the attitude that says in chapter 3 and verse 15, "Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" As he talks to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and he commands them to bow down and worship his gods, he said, "What God is there who can save you from me if I want to put you to death?" And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answer in faith and say, "Our God is able to deliver us." And so there's this contest between the power of Nebuchadnezzar and the power of God. And Nebuchadnezzar throws God's servants into the excessively hot, fiery furnace that's heated seven times over. His greatest tool of destruction is nothing compared to the power of God. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not only do not die, they aren't even singed. They don't even smell like smoke. And so Nebuchadnezzar ends the chapter by saying, in chapter 3 and verse 29, "There is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." And Nebuchadnezzar uses a phrase that's introduced to us in chapter 3 that's an interesting one, and it's particularly interesting, I think, that Nebuchadnezzar is the first one to use it. But Nebuchadnezzar is speaking as he looks at these untouched men walking around in the middle of this fiery furnace. He looks at them in chapter 3, and in verse 26 he says, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." And that's interesting because so far in the book, God, Jehovah, the God that we serve, has been described over and over by Daniel as the God of heaven. And I think what we see in chapter 3 is this pagan polytheistic king who believes in this whole host of gods who have control over all sorts of different things, who previously, up to this point, has thought that his gods were the best gods because he had beaten all these other nations, they had been given into his hand. He sees what God of heaven can do, and he says, "You are most high." He honors God with this, admittedly still imperfect understanding. But he sees something about the power of God compared to the power of himself and other gods. And so for the rest of the book, this phrase, "the Most High," or "the Most High God," is used over and over and over. And so in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is humbled. his pride grows great, and God comes to him at the end of chapter 4 in an episode that we'll read a little more in a moment. And God brings this great king low, and he does so for the purpose of teaching him what he says in chapter 4 in multiple places, but especially verse 32. Until Nebuchadnezzar comes to know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. And I'd suggest to you that that is perhaps the best way to encapsulate the theme of Daniel. It's that verse that shows up multiple times, that the Most High God rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Nebuchadnezzar learns that lesson 3 times. And this is a theme, a message that's consistent with the New Testament. You know, one of the things we've been emphasizing is that the God of the prophets, the God who reveals himself through these books, is the same God that we serve. He hasn't changed, his character hasn't changed, and his authority, his sovereignty, certainly have not changed. And so we get to the New Testament, and we see Jesus, God in the flesh, who comes to earth and very clearly has power over everything. He has power over sickness, over disease. He has power even over death to raise those who have fallen asleep. He has power over the winds and the waves. He commands them to be still and they obey him. And at the end of, toward the end of Jesus' life, when he stands before Pilate in the Gospel of John, he looks at Pilate and he says, "You realize that you have no authority over me besides what God has given to you. Because the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, and he gives it to whom he will." And I think the message is clear and consistent, that God is sovereign. There is a God in heaven who reigns over every earthly power and every earthly authority. And his authority has no end. And so in the second half of the book of Daniel, in the visions and the prophecies that we receive, that is the theme. That there's this cycle of history where nations rise and nations fall. Wicked rulers gain some power for a while, and then when they're at the height of their power, they're brought low. The Most High and his kingdom are what remains. It's the kingdom of God that will not pass away. I'm going to skip a slide because I just talked through the whole thing. That's my attempt at summarizing the narrative sections. That the God of Daniel gives in chapter 1, he reveals in chapter 2, he delivers, and he rules. But I want to talk to you this morning about 3 things. I'm not really going to call them applications, more just 3 lines of thought that I think stem from this understanding of the sovereignty of God as the ruler over the kingdoms of men. 3 things that I think it should force us to think about. The first one comes because I was talking about consistency and how when we get to the New Testament, we see Jesus in the Gospel of John saying things that should remind us of the book of Daniel. And when we get to Romans, we see something similar. In Romans chapter 13, in the first several verses of the chapter, Paul says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those that resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience." Romans chapter 13 is a hard passage. And it's been hard for a lot of people. One of the reasons that it's hard is it's especially difficult to follow Romans 13 or to consider it applicable when the governing authority doesn't seem to be what Paul suggests, a servant of God for our good. It seems like this is a passage that applies when we have a good king or a good president, a good government, but when the opposite is true, it's harder to fit this in. And I think the reason that it fits in is in light of the broader framework that begins in the book of Daniel and understands that God is sovereign, but he allows wicked people sometimes to exercise measures of temporary authority. And the reason that Paul gives to us in Romans chapter 13 that we are to submit to earthly authorities, even when, as so often, we see them setting themselves up against the Most High God, the reason that we remain peaceful when we are mistreated or oppressed by unjust governments, the reason is that we recognize, as Daniel recognized, that ultimately all authority comes from God. That's what Paul says in Romans chapter 13. And although God may permit wicked people to wield some kind of temporary power, he's also made us some promises. And he's promised us that in good time, evil will be punished, and good will be rewarded. And our understanding of God's sovereignty helps us understand that God is able to accomplish his plans, even though the imperfect rule of men may seek its own ends. Because the plans of men, even though they don't know it, they fold into God's plans. And God accomplishes what he wants to accomplish, his eternal purposes, in ways that we can't begin to anticipate. That's one of the lessons, I think, from the book of the prophet Habakkuk. When God comes to Habakkuk and says, I am working in a way that you would not believe if you were told. Our job is not to presume that we understand all the plans of God. Our job is instead, I think, to trust in the Most High and to continue living in faithful service, no matter the situation that we may find ourselves in at the moment. And so in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 19, Paul, who is talking to those who are suffering as Christians, he says, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. And you know, it would be easier, I think, in some ways. It would be easier to construct in our minds a different picture of God's sovereignty. To imagine, as some people have done throughout history, to imagine that there was a Creator who set things in motion and then just kind of stepped back and let humanity take its course. And what we see now is the effects of a world that is untouched by divine help. But that's not the picture that the Bible gives us. In the book of Job, after all, it is to God that Satan comes to ask permission to torment Job, which I think should tell us something about the way the things still work. When in the Old Testament, when Judah prospered and grew strong, it was the Most High God who was ruling in the kingdoms of men and giving it to whom he would. when Babylon rises to power and brings Israel low and takes God's people captive, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom he will. And when Persia takes over in Daniel chapter 5 and Cyrus decrees that the Judean captives be allowed to return home to rebuild their city, it is clearly the Most High God who is ruling in the kingdoms of men and giving it to whom he will. And when Rome becomes powerful and oppresses God's people, even killing Jesus the Christ on a cross, it's the Most High God who rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom he will. And I think God continues to show us through passages like Romans chapter 13 that the governments that exist in our world, whether wicked or somewhat less wicked, they have been put in place by God to serve a purpose for a time. And we may not understand what those purposes are. But again, that's ultimately not our job. Our job is to serve God faithfully wherever he has placed us, and to trust that in his time all things will be made right. In our country, it seems as though every time the ruling political party changes, there's a different group of people who start to question God's purposes and plans. And sometimes I think we're tempted by the trap of thinking that our, in human history, pretty unique position of participating in government somehow changes the level of control that God has over the outcome of world events. If someone that we like is elected, well, it's the will of God, and you might hear some sermons on Romans chapter 13. If someone that we don't like is elected, it's the fault of the people who didn't get out and vote. And what I think we risk is thinking that the rise of democracy somehow affects or lessens the truth of God's sovereignty, when really all it does is make us think that we have justification for disagreeing with his plans. Daniel chapter 4, in verse 35, when Nebuchadnezzar is speaking and praising God after being humbled and then made to see God's authority. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 35, I want you to notice what Nebuchadnezzar says. He does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" When we submit to earthly authority, as we're instructed in Peter and in Romans, when we submit to earthly authorities, we do so not as servants of theirs, but as servants of the Most High God, realizing that he is working in our world, that he is doing things, he is accomplishing his purposes, sometimes in ways that we cannot hope to understand. And he asks from us trust and faithfulness while he carries out his promises. When we talk about submitting, though, we have to talk about allegiance. Because, again, there's a trap that we can fall into. It seems to me that from a biblical perspective, there are two camps, really. There is God and his kingdom, and then there are the nations of the world, as a group, as a clump. Those are the two camps. And so many biblical characters, from Abraham, when he was called to leave his homeland and go out to a better place that God would show him, to Daniel, who experienced being taken from his homeland and living in exile, looking forward to the day when he would get to return somewhere that God had promised. even to Nebuchadnezzar, who is king, ruler over a foreign land, and is forced to acknowledge the control and the authority of the kingdom of God, even over his own power. Even to someone like Demas, who Paul sadly describes as someone who had left him because he loved this present world. So many biblical characters are forced to choose where they will place their allegiance and where they will place their affection. Whether it's on Babylon or the location where they found themselves at the time, or whether it was on the promises and the authority and the plans of God. I thought of this morning when Joel was speaking to us, because sometimes it's easy to look at our situation and our country with rose-colored glasses, where we appreciate its good qualities without recognizing some of its failures. And the reason that I mention that is because I suspect that in the eyes of God, America is very much a wicked nation led by wicked men doing wicked things, just like Assyria in its time, and Babylon in its time, and Rome in its time. And the risk for us is that we will let our allegiance become clouded and our affections to become misplaced. The cycle of history that Daniel presents to us is clear. Nations rise and fall, they accomplish their purposes, and then they are replaced. And it's interesting to me that about halfway through Daniel, the ruling nation changes completely. Babylon is taken out, the king is killed, and Medo-Persia takes over, and there's a new king. And you know what we don't read about? We don't read about Daniel weeping. Instead, I mean, even as long as Daniel lived in Babylon, as many blessings as Daniel enjoyed while being a part of that nation, when a nation falls and a nation rises, Daniel is just faithfully serving God and looking forward to the fulfillment of his promises, because that's where his loyalty lies. That's where his affections are placed. In Hebrews chapter 11, verses 13 through 16 describes some people of faith who lived in tents in foreign lands. They acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. And in Hebrews 11 and verse 14, it says that people who speak thus, in other words, the people who acknowledge that they are strangers and exiles, they make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. And therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. What's our homeland? Because we have a choice. We can be people who are loyal and loving and allegiant to whatever temporary nation we happen to have been born into. Or we can recognize that there is a Most High God who rules over the kingdoms of men and gives them to whom he will, and it is his kingdom that will have everlasting dominion and not pass away. And so if we want to have something that is lasting, that is firm, that is stable, that's where our allegiance needs to be. That's where our hearts need to be. Later in Hebrews 11, in verses 26 through 27, it's talking about Moses. And it says that he considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. And by faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Even the familiar language of 1 John chapter 2, when John talks about not loving the world or the things in the world, for whoever loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Even that language reminds me of the prophecies of Daniel. Because in verse 17 of 1 John chapter 2, what does John say? But the world is passing away, along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. In the vision of Daniel chapter 7, when Daniel sees this image of the Son of Man being given a kingdom from God, an everlasting kingdom that will not pass away, he says in verse 18 that the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever and ever. So again, do we have a choice. Do we trust in where we are now, in what we can see, or do we trust in the Most High God and the kingdom that He rules over, that will never pass away? This nation where we find ourselves, although God has, I think, placed us here to work and to accomplish His will, and although we should, as Jeremiah says to the exiles, we should seek the good of the nation where we find ourselves, this is not our home, because this world is not our home. Finally, I want you to think about something with me, which we don't really have time to flesh out as we should. But it seems to me that there's a natural question that is raised by an understanding of the sovereignty of God the way that Daniel presents it. And that is, how can God, if God is sovereign, if God rules over the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom He will, how can He give it to some of the people that He gives it to? How can God, who is sovereign, reigning over all authorities that are temporarily put in place in this world, how can God allow the kinds of things to happen that happen? Because, as I said earlier, it would be easier to explain if I just thought that God didn't have anything to do with it anymore. It'd be easier to explain if I thought that God were somehow prevented from controlling things the way that they are now, but at some point in the future, He's going to get the reins back and He's going to step back in and make everything right because He's a good and just and loving God. But the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, and He gives it to whom He will. And so I am forced to ask the question about whether I'm comfortable with that. Whether I'm comfortable with an understanding of God's sovereignty that is allowing such suffering and hardship and wickedness to continue. In some ways, I think that's the question of Habakkuk chapter 1. I mentioned Habakkuk a little while ago. And in Habakkuk chapter 1, Habakkuk is talking to God and he says, "Why do you make me look at evil? Why do you make me see iniquity? How long will I cry for help and you will not hear, or cry to you violence and you will not save? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise." And honestly, for all of human history, that's been one of the most pressing objections to the idea of a Christian God. How could a good God allow things to be like this? If He has control, if He has power, if He is sovereign, why does the world look the way that it does? And as I said, we aren't going to try to flesh out that whole question that people have been trying to answer for all of human history. I just want to suggest to you something to think about. God's answer to Habakkuk in chapter 1, when Habakkuk asks God, he says, "You who are of purer eyes than to see evil, You who cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors? Why do you see the things that are happening and just not do anything about it? God's answer to Habakkuk when he responds in chapter 2 is basically to say, I am doing something about it. I am working. I am working now. And trust me, the way in which I'm working, you don't understand, and you might not believe if you did understand. And so that's part of the question. It's not that God is just sitting by and watching the world burn. God is working, and he has been working. One of the ways that he's working is through his people. And so when we work to bear the burdens of others, when we work to ease suffering around us, when we work to heal what is broken, we are working for God. He is working through us. But beyond that, one might ask, as Habakkuk does, you know, why do you delay? Why do your plans take so long? Why don't you just, I mean, God has before in history stepped in the days of Noah and said, you know, this is just too much. Things are too bad. I'm just going to wipe everybody out who's not righteous. So why doesn't God do that again? Well, first of all, I'm not really sure I want God to do that. But I think something that helps me, and maybe it'll help you, when I'm struggling with that question of justifying the control of a Most High God who is able to influence and move, to work among the nations, to raise up kings and bring kings low, God's eternal purpose from the very beginning has involved a plan for fixing brokenness. He promises that there are new heavens and a new earth that will be inherited by his faithful. God's plan is to fix the brokenness. Paul will say in Romans chapter 8, and this is a passage that we're going to go into more deeply in a few weeks, but Paul says in Romans chapter 8 that creation itself is in bondage to corruption, and it is groaning, waiting to be set free. What I'd suggest to you is that the brokenness of this world, even as it continues, that the brokenness of the world itself is a reminder to us, a constant reminder, that God is intending something better for his people and for his creation. There's a song that we sing. I think it's number 415. If you haven't sung it, you could look at it. It's called My God, I Thank You Who Have Made. It's a really good song. And I don't think there's another song like it in the book, at least not that I'm familiar with. But the purpose of the song, it begins thanking God for all of the good things in this earth. Thank for God for all the joy, all the wonderful things that we enjoy in life. And then it gets really real. It acknowledges that life isn't all that great most of the time. That every joy, in verse 3, all our joy is touched with pain. That we have enough, verse 3, that shadows fall on brightest hours, that thorns remain, so that earth's bliss, the happiness we enjoy here, instead of being our chain that binds us here and makes us want to stay here, instead it's a guide. In other words, that we taste goodness, we taste joy, but we're always left wanting more, because of the imperfection of the world that we live in. That's what I mean when I say that I think the brokenness of this world is a constant reminder that God intends something better for us. Because if it weren't for the brokenness that burdens this world, men would never look beyond this world. If it weren't for the consequences and the damage that sin causes in our lives and in the world, people would never come to hate sin. And so God Most High, in His grace, allows the brokenness of this world to endure a little longer, so that as people live in it and feel the overwhelming darkness, and they look for light, they will find Him. And so God, Peter tells us, is patient. He's not slack concerning His promise of judgment. Judgment will come. But He's patient because He wants people to find Him. And so this is the one answer that gives me peace. That as backwards as it may seem at first, just the continued presence of suffering and pain in the world around us is a reminder of the continued grace of our God, who is patient in judgment, and who is constantly working to draw all people to Himself. And I think we can have peace with the sovereignty of God, because we know that the God we serve is the God who controls all, and His plans will never be foiled. His promises will never fail. That the God who delivered Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah from the excessively fiery furnace, the God who delivered Daniel from certain death in a den of lions, He has promised that He will deliver His people, even through death, and that there is something better coming. The promise of Revelation chapter 21, where there will be no cause for crying, there will be no hurt to cause pain, there will be no death to mourn. That's the better thing that we are looking forward to. We're going to sing a song in a minute that talks about the sovereignty of God and invites people to become a part of this kingdom. Some kingdoms, it's hard to become a part of. God's kingdom is open to all. We sang about that a little bit in the Lord's Supper song this morning. God's kingdom is open to all. All it requires is that you feel your need of Him and accept His lordship and submit yourself to His will. And if you're willing to do that, you can become a part of something that will never pass away. It'll never be overthrown. It'll never have a recession or depression or stock market crash that throws the whole system into an uproar. God's kingdom will stand because the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whom He will. If you would, if you need to respond to the call of the gospel, we invite you to take this opportunity and come while we stand and sing this song.